This is oral history interview number 19. We are talking today with Dr. Eugene J. Breebach, the Washington University School of Medicine, class of 1905. Dr. Breebach, you were saying a few minutes ago of the origin of your name.
Well, it was supposed to be B.A.C., and when the Protestants were run out of France, they were invited by Frederick the Great to come to Germany. And evidently they went to Germany and they added the final H to the name Breebach. Now, I don't know where they started out in France. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was probably in southern France.
Do you have...
There were two Breebachs in St. Louis.
Oh, there are.
My father, Eugene, mm-hmm. and his brother, Benno,
mm-hmm.
both of them physicians.
So you come from a line of physicians, your father and
my uncle.
And your uncle.
Yes.
When did the Breebachs come to the United States? Do you have any information on that?
My father and his brother came to the United States evidently when they were youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
My father may have been about 12 or 13 or 14 years old.
I see.
Old.
Mm-hmm.
And they settled in Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Did they come with their parents?
Out near Fort Harker.
Fort Harker.
That's about the middle of Kansas.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And they ran into 2 years of grasshoppers.
Mm-hmm.
And they cleaned them. And my dad came down to the Missouri River and he got a job as cook on a steamboat.
How old was he then? Approximately.
This was 1870.
1870.
And the reason he remembered the date was that they got the news that Chicago was burning.
They did.
So that's mm-hmm. that dates the thing mm-hmm. pretty accurately.
Yes, it certainly does.
He got this job and mm-hmm. landed in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finally got to be a druggist.
I see.
He and
did he
his
go
brother
to school?
Had a drugstore in South St. Louis.
In South St. Louis.
In Carondelet.
Well, did at that time, sometimes persons learn their medicine by being apprenticed to a
I
doctor.
I don't know.
Do you know how he did?
My
he go
father from? Was a graduate of the, I think it was the Beaumont Hospital Medical College.
Yes, I remember. I believe there
Beaumont
was
Hospital
there was
Medical
there
College.
Was such an institution in St. Yes. Louis, I believe.
That's
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, he went. He was one of the three physicians who started St. Mary's Infirmary.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Down on 1536 Papin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they started there because the sisters had been donated the old Costi residence.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And pretty soon after that, they built this hospital. It wasn't long after that they enlarged it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they founded Mount St. Rose later on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started branches in the Wisconsin and Missouri and elsewhere. I
mm-hmm.
don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Did your father practice medicine in St. Louis then for most of his life?
Yes, always.
For always.
He was gynecologist, man.
I see. So he did have a specialty too.
Well,
or
was
how did that work?
Gynecology.
I see.
Mostly
mm-hmm.
gynecology.
And was he connected with St. Mary's then?
Yes,
as
he was
a physician.
With St. Mary's for many years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know just how many
mm-hmm.
years.
Were there any hospitals? Was he affiliated with? This was before Barnes Hospital I suppose.
The city hospital was down
the city
there
hospital.
In our area.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not. He was not busy in the city hospital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to go into medicine then?
Well, my father was a physician,
mm-hmm.
and my mother rather urged me. I wanted to go into the Navy.
I see.
But my
mm-hmm.
mother kind of talked me out of
mm-hmm.
that, and I went into medicine.
Your
so
life,
I went to mm-hmm. Washington. And you know, you mentioned Dr. Budgett's name here.
Mm-hmm.
Sidney Budgett. There was a statement in the catalog that you should pay your dues when you entered the school.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But I was looking for a bill from the office.
Yes.
So I let it run along for a while, and then I went to his office one day and asked him about it. He said, well, you should have paid this so-and-so, the book says, and he read this, that you do when you enter this.
Yes.
And I think he added interest.
Oh.
To the date, to the time that I was overdue, and I was so damn mad I thought I'd quit the school.
Yes.
Because there wasn't nothing said about
actually
paying it on the spot cash. And, but I stayed with it, and I graduated with that same class, of course.
So now, 1905, well, what was the official name of the medical school then?
I think it was the Medical Department of Washington University.
Yes, I do
but
remember.
It had been the St. Louis Medical College up to that time. It was down on Locust Street, 18th and Locust.
18th and Locust.
Yes.
Yes, I believe, I was looking at the history this morning, I believe it was 1891 when St. Louis Medical College affiliated with Washington University mm-hmm. as the medical department.
And also the Missouri Medical College.
Yes, I believe they came in at 1899.
You see,
so that the two branches were joined then.
When I was going to medical school, at the building up there on Jefferson Avenue that had been the medical college, Missouri Medical College, was our one of our clinical.
I see.
One of our clinical
mm-hmm.
buildings.
Well,
I worked in the GU clinic there mm-hmm. with Dr. Robinson.
What type of curriculum did you have in those days? Can you tell something about it?
The first year was anatomy. Anatomy, physiology, and that's all I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we had some pharmacology mm-hmm. the first year.
It might list the courses
is
in,
all
here.
In here.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
It probably does list
quality
the courses
board,
in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt that's in here.
Do you remember how large your class was?
100.
About
100.
Uh-huh.
About 100.
And that doesn't include then the whole school.
That's just your medical school.
That's interesting because they stayed at about 100 for quite some time before its recent expansion. They pretty well
And
held
the result
to that.
Is now we're importing doctors from Egypt, and the Near East, and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why we shouldn't have enough doctors mm-hmm. produced in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But we're out there in the country, these foreigners are not capable mm-hmm. of delivering real medical mm-hmm. service, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
How can they talk to a patient and get symptomatology
mm-hmm.
when they don't know the customs of the
mm-hmm.
country and food habits and so forth. Of course, they learn them after a while.
Did you feel that this is looking ahead? But I can't. Were you the only doctor for some distance there, or did you feel you were really overworked?
Oh, no, this town is sort of a railroad center. You see,
mm-hmm.
it's always been a rather important
mm-hmm.
town. In fact, it's
mm-hmm.
been getting smaller
mm-hmm.
since I've been there.
I see. Mm-hmm.
That's one reason why I love it.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't the rat race mm-hmm. that there is in bigger cities.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then but at the same time, you were able to specialize too. In the areas that interest you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's an area. It's a very prosperous area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mostly farmland.
Mm-hmm. And do you say your specialty was gynecology, or was that?
No, my specialty.
That was your father's specialty.
John McCullough.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what did you have a specialty?
No, I didn't. I was going to be a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of got into it. I was roommate when I was intern at the city hospital
mm-hmm.
with Harry Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry Lincoln had talked to Green Post in Ewing, and he was going to go there and do eye work.
Mm-hmm. In Leavenworth?
No, or in Atchison.
Oh, in Atchison, okay.
In Atchison. Mm-hmm. No, do eye work in St. Louis at the Green Post in Ewing office.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And he said he was going to throw it up. And I kind of had a hankering for eye work, mm-hmm. and so I went, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there and talked to Dr. Ewing about it, and Dr. Mm-hmm. Ewing said, all right, come on. So I was with Green Post and Ewing for 3 years.
In St. Louis.
In St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what made you decide to move?
Well, from the Green Post and Ewing office, I went for 2 years in Germany.
Well, that's certainly interesting.
Mm-hmm. Doing eye work.
In specializing in
eye work. Mm-hmm. Yes. I went to England, and I put in some time there, mm-hmm. at the big eye hospital, the biggest eye hospital in the world,
mm-hmm.
in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I put in some time in French,
mm-hmm.
France,
mm-hmm.
in Paris,
mm-hmm.
watching the eye work there. And a lot of things about it I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that was the place I wanted to study. That
mm-hmm.
I was the only American there in the eye department.
Mm-hmm. What do you did you have facility then with language so that you could?
Well, I had trouble in the language, of
mm-hmm.
course. I
mm-hmm.
had some school instruction,
mm-hmm.
and I'd heard some German spoken
mm-hmm.
around in South St. Louis, which was more German then
mm-hmm.
than it is now,
mm-hmm.
probably. And I had a system. I had a dictionary, an English-German dictionary. I get hold of the daily paper and start in the upper left-hand corner. And every word I came to, I put on a list,
mm-hmm.
every word that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a very short time, I was able to get along pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. Was you decided then to study in Strasbourg, were they ahead of the United States then in the eye work?
Well, Professor Stargardt
mm-hmm.
was the chief there,
mm-hmm.
and he was a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful teacher and a real scientist, you know, and he had a very, very good setup. So I worked with Stargardt there for about 7-8 months, and from there I went to Freiburg to Oxenfeld's clinic. And Oxenfeld, who was the editor of the Klinische Monatsblätter für Augenheilkunde, was ahead, and he was
mm-hmm.
a whiz,
mm-hmm.
and I stayed there about a year, and then from there I went to Heidelberg,
mm-hmm.
and put in some more time, and then my money ran out, and I had to come home.
Well, it certainly was an opportunity to study with these people in Europe.
Well, I went to Europe with the idea of getting some instruction in physiological optics.
I see.
I didn't know where I could get it in the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have very much mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the Sorbonne, where I applied, the man that was teaching that did not speak English, and he didn't speak German even. He had he spoke French and Norwegian.
Mm-hmm.
So I never got physiological optics.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I watched the work there at the in Paris, and I saw some very good work and some very poor work
mm-hmm.
there. And then I went on to Strasbourg, and I just loved Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm. Did you come back to St. Louis then after your time in Germany?
Yeah. But before I went to Germany and before I went into eye work,
mm-hmm.
I was an intern at the city hospital.
Mm-hmm. Can you
tell us? Now, the interesting thing about that was that the old city hospital had been destroyed by the tornado of 92, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
May the 27th, 1892, I think it was, or maybe it was 1896. I don't remember.
Well, we could look that up, but were you there during that
and
time?
All of those buildings were torn down, and so the city hospital took up the abandoned convent on 18th and Pine, the Sisters of St. Anthony.
I see.
And that's mm-hmm. where I was an intern. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we moved over to the new buildings mm-hmm. that had been put up, so that mm-hmm. we were the first group in the new city hospital.
Mm-hmm. Did the responsibilities as an intern, were they about the same as today? Or how much...
things have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We interns were lodged in one of the buildings there, and we got our food and our laundry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Nothing else. So
nothing else. No compensation other than that. But it was a very good system, because the medical schools of St. Louis used the clinical material in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And these men would come to lecture. And they would come and ask us what interesting cases we had, and of course we referred them. And we had the privilege of listening in on their talks, on our patients.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, the same patient was presented to the men of the different schools, so we listened to the varying opinions.
I see. That must have been very interesting.
That was interesting, yes. I don't know whether any student today ever has a comparable privilege.
Yes, that must have been very interesting.
Yes.
Now, in your time as a medical student, how many years was the program then? Did you say you started in 1900?
I was a junior 1 year, and then a senior. I don't remember when they were about 24 or 23 or 24 junior interns.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then there were about 4 senior interns,
mm-hmm.
and the seniors were selected from the juniors.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, most of us only stayed 1 year.
Yes, so not everyone would stay 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Then there was assistant superintendent
mm-hmm.
and the superintendent, who
mm-hmm.
was John Young Brown
mm-hmm.
in my day.
I see.
John
mm-hmm.
Young Brown was...
Could you tell something about him?
Well, he knew good whiskey when he saw it, I think. And he was a well-trained man. He'd been trained in Philadelphia by Price.
Mm-hmm.
And... Well,
now that's so. Now, how much undergraduate training did you have? Did you have to graduate from college at that time?
No, I went from high school to medical school.
You went from high school to medical school.
So I was only 24 years old when I graduated in 1901.
Mm-hmm. How many years then did you? You mentioned you spent one year as an intern. How many years did you actually spend in the previous to that in the medical school? Do you remember that offhand? I don't think the program was 4 years then.
Oh, yes, it was 4 years.
What was it? Oh, it was.
It was 4 years.
So it was four, but you did go from high school right into medical school,
but
then you spent 4 years in medical school
mm-hmm.
and then 1 year as an intern.
Yeah. But we didn't do so bad. I was
mm-hmm.
in the upper 10
mm-hmm.
of the class.
Mm-hmm.
So
very
that
good.
It wasn't too much of a handicap.
Mm-hmm. No, it would take
mm-hmm.
someone that was intelligent, I think,
to
do that.
I don't know about that.
Not everyone could. Did everyone come from high school?
I was a high school boy.
Did everyone come from high school, or did some go to college first?
Oh, some of them were superintendents of schools and so forth.
Oh, they were.
And we had some graduates from Harvard there.
Oh, I see.
And,
mm-hmm.
No, we had all varieties.
So it was a little yeah. more flexible then than it is now. You
yes.
could go to college and then go on, or you could go
now,
right
Jerome
on.
Cook,
uh-huh.
who practiced here in St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
as an internist, was also a high school graduate.
I see. Mm-hmm.
We came from the same part of town, mm-hmm. so just for Jerome Cook and I were mm-hmm. good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Both high school boys and went to medical school right out of high school.
Was he in your class then?
Yes.
With you?
Mm-hmm. We were parallel, and we were, he was not only in my class, but we were interns at the mm-hmm. city hospital together.
I see.
Now, we had, you see, there were 150 applicants for those jobs at the city hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That was considered a very good internship.
I see.
There were 150 applicants and only 25 jobs.
So there was competition in those times too for the positions.
We started this examination. We wrote our essays under non-diplome, and we started in, as I remember, at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we closed at either 5 or 6
mm-hmm.
in the afternoon, and there was no time out for lunch.
I worked straight
through.
That
was the first time that I lost my accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
I really hit that as hard as I could,
mm-hmm.
and I believe I ranked 4th or 5th in that. So I got a job out of that,
mm-hmm.
all right.
That's very good.
Yeah. But I was just a high school boy, and a lot of these boys were university men, of course,
mm-hmm.
applying for this job.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington University did very well on that competition,
mm-hmm.
as against the other school here.
You mentioned earlier that you had Vilray P. Blair as one of your instructors. Could you tell us something about him or about his classes?
Well, Vilray Blair, of course, he was a French extraction. The old French people in town, he was belonged to that.
I see.
That
now that's very interesting.
And he was a erratic sort of a guy, you know. But he had no bad habits as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was erratic
mm-hmm.
as hell. He was a good instructor in anatomy. He knew
mm-hmm.
anatomy.
So
of course, later on, he became an expert in
plastic surgery, wasn't it?
Plastic surgery.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So he had no anatomy there, too.
Yes,
know.
That's true.
So that was his foundation
mm-hmm.
right there that he was building up at that time.
That's an important point,
mm-hmm.
that he did have that foundation
oh,
in,
yes.
in
well,
anatomy.
Oh, yes, he had it all right.
And he was an instructor in
yeah.
that.
So during the
uh-huh.
war, he, during the First World War, and I was in the First World War, of course. I was first lieutenant.
I see.
Was
that, well, you didn't, did you happen to be in the unit affiliated with
No,
Washington
I was not.
University?
I was out in Kansas by that
You
time.
Were out in Kansas, uh-huh.
And I didn't go in with any group.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took it as it came.
Mm-hmm.
And so I fitted shoes and did general work for quite a while
mm-hmm.
before I got into ophthalmology.
I see. Mm-hmm.
In the army, it took quite a while
mm-hmm.
to get into it.
Did you? Were you in France then during the war?
No, I didn't get to France.
Mm-hmm.
I got to Georgia. That's as far as
mm-hmm.
I got.
But you were finally then. They did give you work in your field.
Yes.
The
yeah, but it was lousy.
what was bad about it?
There wasn't very much organization,
mm-hmm.
and the people there were not well informed. That is, I, as a young student, didn't learn anything from it.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And we had the hardships of being in the field, which was something that
mm-hmm.
we weren't accustomed to, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We were assigned tents down in an area where there's a lot of drainage of water, and it happened to be a wet season.
I see.
So we had wet clothes because there was no floor
mm-hmm.
in our tent. Although half a block away there were hundreds of vacant tents with good floors that were not being used.
I see.
Now that was just one example
mm-hmm.
of how an army is run.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't only true in the American army, it was true in the German army, because later on, when I was over there at Strasbourg, I talked to a lot of these boys who were in the war,
mm-hmm.
German who were, I guess it must have been later that I talked to them about that, because they told me there was a lot of misplacement in the German army too.
Mm-hmm.
That is, men who had the ability to do special work were not placed for in that kind of work.
Well, you didn't. Did you stay in tents the whole time you were in Georgia? Didn't they give you permanent housing after
that? No, it was. I think the army was going to pieces at that time. I think the prospect of peace was already in the air.
I see.
And discipline was out of the window. Mm-hmm. And it was a slipshod setup.
Mm-hmm. When did you enter the army? Was it in 1918?
1918, and I got out in
1919.
I was there about a year.
Mm-hmm. Year. Did you volunteer, or was there a draft?
Volunteer.
Uh-huh.
But the draft was coming in, so we volunteered.
Mm-hmm. I see. Mm-hmm. Well, to talk a little bit more about your teachers at the medical school, which others did you have that you considered outstanding?
Well, Terry, of course, was the one I was most fond of.
Robert J. Terry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What?
And Dr. Tiedemann.
Tiedemann?
Pathology.
And pathology.
Yeah, we loved him. Mm-hmm.
Now, I've heard of a lot about Dr. Terry because we have his papers in the medical library archives, and I was going to show them to you later.
Terry was a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant man, and he's a hard worker, mm-hmm. of course. And he had a definite course,
mm-hmm.
and he stuck to it. And you had to do your stuff
mm-hmm.
or get out of there. So that quite a number of the boys quit after they dissected a while.
I see.
It was pretty hard going.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us anything else about Dr. Terry? Why was he? You know, you mentioned he was a very
intelligent, very
but you
very definite, very mm-hmm. strict.
Mm-hmm. Was he kind also, or why did you like him? I guess I'm going to ask you, since he was very strict and tough.
I just loved the man because he was bound up in his work, mm-hmm. and he did his work, mm-hmm. and he was never unkind,
mm-hmm.
as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fond of him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our profession of physiology was lackadaisical,
mm-hmm.
and easygoing.
Mm-hmm.
And during all the time that we were there, I can remember one animal experiment.
I see.
In a whole
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
On the action of epinephrine.
Mm-hmm. So it turned out to be a very easy course, but it doesn't sound you learned very much from it.
No, we didn't learn
uh-huh.
very much. We didn't get any laboratory work.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to tell me his name, or would you prefer not to?
Oh, it doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
Budget. Sidney P. Budget.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of him for a long
mm-hmm.
time. He was an Englishman,
mm-hmm.
and he taught like the English do. Now, when I went to Europe, I stopped at Oxford, and one of the men there at Oxford showed me around and told me things about Oxford University.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the system of examinations at intervals to see whether you're keeping up. At the end of the year they have an examination.
Mm-hmm.
And then you decide whether you're still going to stay there or whether you're going on. In other words, there was they left it to the individual. Now, our system here was more like the
mm-hmm.
Germans. That is, if you don't do one and two, you can't take three and four.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me another thing that was about the English system. Now, I was over there, this was 1909,
mm-hmm.
in November 1909 that I landed there. And he said that The teaching of the humanities had been the business of Oxford and Cambridge, and they had no scientific department until about 1908.
Is that recent?
Is that recent, yeah. Mm-hmm. I recall that. Those dates mm-hmm. may not be mm-hmm. exactly right, but that's what I recall.
Were there courses in medical school about chemistry or biochemistry?
Well, we had very little biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And we had the chemistry. Now, we had chemistry at high school.
Mm-hmm.
And the course in chemistry just about duplicated what we had in high school.
Mm-hmm. Was Dr. Schaefer, I don't believe he was the head of the chemistry, biochemistry at that time, was he?
Dr. Warren. Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Was our chemistry teacher.
We have Dr. Schaefer's papers, but he's from a slightly later time, and I think that applies to Dr. Graham, Everett Graham was at a later time too, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
And there's someone else that I was trying to remember.
Graham was the man that started the lung surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. And he you know had a long and distinguished career here, and we are fortunate we do have his papers, and I'll show them to you.
Mm-hmm.
You did mention Sherwood Moore. Now we have his papers too.
Well, Sherwood Moore was a classmate.
He was,
and then we were interns at the City Hospital together.
I see.
And then when he left there, he went with a group of some kind for the Guggenheim Foundation, and they went to the Congo, and he was in the Congo for a while.
That's interesting. I hadn't realized that.
He was in the Congo for a while. Well, it's interesting. I have a nephew who was down there in the Congo and just came back because they were getting too rough. They're beginning to fight.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Beginning to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that Sherwood went there, I think, was to develop the copper in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason my nephew was there now was to build a transmission line 400 miles up into the copper area.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's quite a stretch mm-hmm. of time, you see, probably 75 years. 70 years. Things that I happen to remember was when we were going to school, Dr. Fischel had been in Germany, and he pulled out of his vest pocket a little vial, and he says, "There is a wonderful drug. The name is aspirin."
Really?
Yeah.
Now,
it's a new drug. Now that
a new drug.
This is in about 1904, something like that.
So you were a student then.
I was a student. In
and Dr. Fischel, was he
medicine. He was lecturing on
medicine here at the medical school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And his son was in my class, in our class.
I see.
Walter Fischel was in the same class with us. Walter Fischel also was an intern at the City Hospital at the same time.
I know those names turn up in some of the book plates on the mm-hmm. some of the rare books that we have are due to those men. Do you remember offhand any other teachers you found were outstanding or not so outstanding in medical school? You told us some interesting things.
Well, of course, Henry Schwartz was our teacher in obstetrics.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
gave a party once a year at his home to the medical school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beer party.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And you had to tell a story as you went around mm-hmm. the table where the boys were drinking beer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wish I could remember some of those stories, but
mm-hmm.
they would hardly be proper material for a conference of any kind.
Yes.
They were the medical stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, What did Sherwood Moore start out in? What was his field at the beginning?
Just general. His brother was a practicing physician here. I don't know what he did.
Do you know how he got into radiology then?
No, I don't know how he got into it.
That of course was his specialty. No.
I always told Sherwood he was kind of snooty. But he didn't talk very much, you know. Uh-huh. He didn't reveal very much.
I see.
But we were northerners and he was a southern, you know.
I see.
There was a little difference there. You know, how we thought about things.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about medical school and then your internship and your study in Germany. And how long did you stay in St. Louis then before going out to Kansas?
Well, I was in St. Louis. Really, I didn't stop in St. Louis. I went right out there
when you came back to Germany.
Because
you went to Kansas.
One of my friends had told me that the reason was that I had built up some notes, some cash due notes.
Mm-hmm.
And although they weren't very big, as looked at but modernized, they looked pretty big to me then.
Yes.
And I knew that starting in St. Louis would be a little bit slow.
Mm-hmm.
And
because all the doctors,
I suppose, it's a medical school
mm-hmm.
center, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the boys a lot of them stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I could do better and quicker
mm-hmm.
in a small place. Although I always thought that I was too good to go to the country town,
mm-hmm.
but I found out later that the country town's a pretty nice place to be.
Yes.
In the first place, we had good duck shooting out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the course of a year and a half, I had some friends out there.
Yes.
And it was really a very pleasant place to live.
Mm-hmm.
As against a not so pleasant place in the big city.
Yes, I can certainly understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, earlier you mentioned...
I got my notes paid off in a hurry,
mm-hmm.
that's all I can tell you.
And you decided to stay once you were there.
All right, I didn't have any trouble paying off my notes.
Yes.
It's been very different here, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that Leavenworth you went to right away?
No, no.
This was Atchison.
And I've been there ever since.
And you've been there ever since.
And I never thought I'd be there more. I went there with the idea of staying about a year and a half
mm-hmm.
or 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been there now for 63 years.
63 years.
64 years.
No, that's a good lifetime, isn't it?
That's quite a lifetime.
That's
practicing longer than most people
mm-hmm.
practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, and has your practice been general medicine? No. It's just
ophthalmology.
Just ophthalmology.
Eye,
mm-hmm.
ear, nose, and throat, but
mm-hmm.
mostly ophthalmology.
I see. Mm-hmm. So you have been able to specialize there just as you would have done had you stayed in St. Louis.
Well,
I got
into a nose and throat when I was going to school at Freiburg in Germany.
I see. Mm-hmm.
The greatest teacher in nose and throat in the world probably was Gustav Kilian, and he was teaching there. And he was a marvelous teacher, and I went over. I was interested in the diseases of the sinuses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one, sphenoidal empyema causes blindness at times.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I want to know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And here was this authority on the sinuses.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over there to Gustav Kilian, and I enjoyed his work a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good teacher and a very easy man to get along with. A good teacher is something that's got to have a combination of something. He's got to have certain warmth, and he's got to be an authority at the same time. And some authorities don't have that warmth. Now, the teacher that I was very fond of at medical school here was Dr. Tiedemann.
Oh,
he was a teacher of pathology.
Mm-hmm.
We called him Papa Tiedemann.
I see.
Papa Tiedemann, and he was beloved generally, mm-hmm. and a man who had learned, I think he learned his pathology in Germany.
Well,
I don't know about his.
Why was, what was there about, was it his personality that made you like him, or why did you like him?
Well, he was a good teacher.
A good teacher.
He was just
so
a good
you
teacher. He knew his stuff, and you could get it from him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was generally true. I think everybody liked Dr. Thielen.
Now, at the, I suppose at that time, Germany was considered to be more advanced in medicine than the United States.
Undoubtedly, yes.
And did you feel...
Better than English and better than French, I thought.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Germany, did you feel that you had the background that you needed to study there? Of course, by that time, you had been an intern.
No, I'd had 3 years of eye work here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I see these interns doing major operations. We weren't allowed to do any operations.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We just watched the professor. Although, we saw a good practitioner work and do good work.
Mm-hmm.
And being an assistant to him for several years, you learned something.
Yes.
Yes. I worked with Dr. Ewing and then went with Dr. Green.
Mm-hmm. Both at the medical school here.
Well, at their office.
Oh, at their office.
When I was their assistant, you see.
I see. Now,
that's where I got $58 a month.
That doesn't sound like very much.
$58 a month after
now.
Having been interned at the city hospital, you see.
Doesn't sound like very much now, but at the time, I'm sure
these
it was
boys get $1,000 a month now.
Sure, it was a respectable amount at the time.
Well, the same boy gets $1,000 a month now.
Mm-hmm. So you had your MD. You graduated from the medical school. You'd been an intern at City
Hospital
for a year, and then you became, after that, an assistant.
3 years of assistant.
3 years
Green
of
Post
assistant at Greenhouse.
Yeah.
Did you? What did you do as an assistant then? Did you do operations? You said that.
Well, I did refractions.
Refractions mostly.
Yes. And of course, local medication.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't harp on surgery like some of them did. We used to go up to Melanthry Hospital.
Where was that?
For instruction in surgery.
Was that in St. Louis?
In
St. Louis.
We were going to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Part
mm-hmm.
of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Dr. Carson was operating, and we were sitting in the circle in the amphitheater looking down on the operating table.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur Mitchell Gregg was a comic. He had a sense of the peculiar. And he looked down there, and the doctor hit the renal artery.
Mm-hmm.
And the blood just came out in volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked down there and says, "My God," he says, "send for a plumber." that's one thing I remember about Greg. But he died some time ago. He was I can't think of names anymore. I forget names.
We have here this list of we have several lists here. One is of faculty members, and I'm looking through that to see that you did mention Dr. Terry, and I think he's the only person we have. The only person's papers we have that dates from that time. We do have in the archives the papers of William Beaumont, and that is our one of our prized possessions.
Yes.
That has been preserved. And then the other list we have here is the graduates of the Washington University Medical School in 1905. And perhaps you'd like to look at this list and tell us a little bit about some of your classmates.
Alexander. Well, Alexander went down and got the job at the Missouri Pacific Hospital. He worked there for years. Ambrister, Anderson, Beeson. I remember these fellows. Mm-hmm. Betts, Brewster, Breba. Brewster was from over in Illinois somewhere. Broussard. Pierre Broussard. He's French.
Mm-hmm.
A likable person. He worked alongside of me. He used to bawl me out once in a while. Chalkley. Klein. Jerome Cook. What does it say about Jerome?
You mentioned him earlier, too, I believe.
He was a very dear friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Professor of Pathology and Bacteriology. I didn't know that. Oh, in the dental department at the Jewish Hospital. I see that. Physician of St. Louis City Hospital, St. Louis Maternity, St. Louis Medical, American Medical Society, Metropolitan Building, yeah. Walter Fischel, MD 19-5, AB 19-2 from Harvard, you see?
Yes, so he did have that training behind him. And
yeah.
You were in a very competitive situation then with people.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. we didn't do so that.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis and American Medical Association, Hospital of Alumni, Medical Society, Washington University of Alumni. Humboldt Building. And he's gone too. He's gone. Goodman quit when he's in his first year.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, he quit.
Well, he's listed there as a graduate, though, isn't
he? No, but he didn't graduate.
I see.
Arthur Mitchell Gregg, yeah. He's the boy I told you about. Kappa Sigma, Phi Beta Pi,
mm-hmm.
manager of the class baseball team, City Hospital, physician and surgeon on the staff. City Hospital. Well, he was a junior like with me.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis Almshouse. Santa Fe Railroad Health Commissioner, City of Joplin. He was down in Joplin. I occasionally had somebody come up from Joplin and
mm-hmm.
they used to talk to me about him. He did very well down there. Griffith, Louis Guggenheim, cum laude. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Guggenheim got a cum laude. 1905. Where did he get a cum laude? Because I remember him.
I see. Well, maybe the record is, it's possible the record is not completely accurate.
Phi Beta Pi, surgery and outpatients. Year Department, Washington University, lecture upon disturbances, speech and voice.
Unless it refers to his undergraduate degree.
Well, see, this is his graduate school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hale Hamilton came to Kansas City, Jackson County Medical Society. He was an obstetrician. He did all right. And Hastings went up to Alton Medical Society. And I was up in Alton here not so terribly long ago, and I couldn't find any trace of him. I
mm-hmm.
knew he was there, but so he had left. He's gone on too.
Mm-hmm.
Hawkins. Well, here it says Bert Chamberlain Kern. James Jacob Hulsman. Hulsman was probably the best doctor in the whole bunch. It's naturally. Doesn't say anything about him here.
Did
24 in North Carolina, St. Louis, Missouri.
It doesn't say anything more about it. Did he specialize in a certain
he
field?
He was an internist.
An internist.
I'll mm-hmm. tell you about him. You know, we had a rule at the city hospital that if a patient came to autopsy and you had treated him, you were supposed to be there at the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that autopsy revealed whose diagnosis was closest.
Mm-hmm.
And Hulsman hit him on the head every time.
I see.
He just had it. And then later on, he went out to Denver.
What was the, you mentioned the man whose story we should hear.
Hulsman.
Hulsman.
He's a good man. He was a brilliant. You know, we had a rotating system at the city hospital. Every month, you went to another department.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to write up the history of every case in the new department.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could differ with these guys or agree with them, you see. And
I
then
see.
When they came to autopsy, there was a place to see who made a diagnosis.
Yes.
All right. Now, Hildeman was good. No, that's all. He had anybody else on the bunch skin.
Mm-hmm.
He got his training up there at Melanthry Hospital under Smith, Professor Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Who was on the staff up there at Melanthry. McMillan, McMurdo, McNutt, Minton went to St. Joseph, Missouri. Sherwood Moore, Richmond, Virginia. According to that, he practiced down there in Virginia. That's all. George M. Park.
Now, I think that's the Dr. Park that's still here in St. Louis. I may have his name, but it seems to me there is. I met a Dr. Park who borrowed some things from the archives.
I heard he lost his vision. I heard he was blind.
Well,
he's glaucoma.
He's still able to read. He borrowed one of our books.
He did.
On Oliver Wendell Holmes, The Autocrat at the Breakfast Table. He was in the archives a month or two ago.
I think
it's the same man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's
only
still
one George Park.
That's
we worked
probably
at
right.
The same dissection table.
I see.
So I know George Park.
You should. I'll look up his address. You should give him a telephone call when you're here.
5898 Cavani Avenue.
I should be able to find his telephone number for you.
Strode Thomas Thompson. He's A.M. Master of Arts from Hanover College. I think he was alcoholic. I don't remember much about him. I don't know whatever became of him. Bonamy. East St. Louis. Wobus. Kurtzman Prize in Chemistry. He was a good worker, that boy was. Assistant in gynecology at Washington University Hospital. Gynecology at Barnard Skin and Cancer Hospital. Lieutenant in the Medical Reserve Corps, Assistant Surgeon Jewish Hospital, Orthopedic Surgeon St. Louis City Hospital, contributor to Missouri State Medical Journal, member of the Northern University and City Clubs, Metropolitan Building. Say, where does the University Club have their building now?
They used
to be down on Washington.
Until about this past year, they were downtown, and now they've built a new building in Clayton. It's on
way out there.
Look, it's way out there. It's a multi-story building that looms out over the over everything else there. And of course, it's a brand new facility. Very nice.
Do they own it?
Yes, I believe the University Club does own it.
Build it. Mm-hmm.
And rents out to other tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, at least that is the name of the building, University Club Building.
They used to be down on Grand Avenue and mm-hmm. Washington.
Mm-hmm. They were down there until a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And when they finally moved.
I'm a member of the University Club in Kansas City.
I see.
And they reciprocate.
Mm.
So I thought I would use the University Club mm-hmm. while I was here in town, but I couldn't. But I know then that they moved, and I didn't know where they moved, so I was afraid to try them out. That wouldn't have helped me much to be out there in Clayton, would it?
That would have been some ways from the medical school.
Yeah.
Yes. You mentioned, I think before we started the interview, that you knew Dr. Trotter. She wasn't teaching here when you were here, was she? This was
no, but Terry was teaching.
Dr. Terry was here. Uh-huh. Did you have later associations with Dr. Trotter?
No, I came down here just to visit occasionally, you know,
yes.
And then,
mm-hmm.
then I met her on one of those
mm-hmm.
visits.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But she didn't follow Dr. Terry straight out, did she?
Well,
she
hasn't been the head of the department, but she has worked in the department.
Mm-hmm.
After Dr. Terry, I've forgotten his name now. Dr. Terry was the head of the department until 1941. I can't think of the man who replaced him offhand, but I do have it here in the records.
Yeah.
And Dr. I think Dr. Trotter said that she served under four or five different department heads.
Mm-hmm.
Which
so there have been some changes there
mm-hmm.
along.
There have been changes, and she has stayed.
How many?
We were talking about the role of women as doctors, and you were giving some comments about that.
Well, I've always been prejudiced.
I see.
But
mm-hmm.
women like that, you know, you know that there's mm-hmm. no ground for prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I discussed that once with a friend of mine, and he said, I asked him, I said, why is it that we don't have confidence in women doctors? Well, it's just probably a prejudice, but there's usually some reason for a prejudice. And his idea was that women don't take responsibility like men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. It was very rare at that time. Were there any women medical students in your class?
No.
None at all.
No. It was kind of unthinkable, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
But then the women kept coming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're going into ophthalmology and they're getting to be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know of any outstanding mm-hmm. ophthalmologist who's a woman. Do you?
Not offhand. Of course, it could be argued that they haven't been given the opportunity, but that's
haven't been given the opportunity. A man makes his opportunity. That isn't something that comes from heaven. It's something you have to hammer out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the circumstances are difficult is a spur rather than a deterrent. I use that argument against the blacks.
I see.
I don't know any reason why the middle class of Americans should be taxed to make it easy for a black to live on food stamps today. Do you?
Well, I suppose the same argument would be used.
Yeah, because your great-great-grandfather mm-hmm. had a slave that was black. Mm-hmm. Was that the reason why you should toil now and be taxed? So that his great-great-great-grandchildren mm-hmm. should live in ease without working?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of these subjects reminds me that we really haven't talked about one area. Have you been active in politics at all?
No, sir. I've been active in my work, and
yes.
I'm worked to death.
Mm-hmm.
Just like most any doctors,
mm-hmm.
worked to death.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching. They're slaves. They don't have time for anything else. Medicine calls on you 24 hours a day if you're a practitioner.
Do you feel that then that you've had to work harder than you should have?
No. Yeah. I haven't worked as hard as I should.
Oh, well, that's interesting. How do you account for that? I mean, you said what I believe to be true also, that doctors are slaves to their work, and sure. I think earlier you mentioned that there aren't enough American doctors being trained. Right. How can you say you haven't worked hard enough?
Well, I ought to know more. I don't know enough. Oh. I haven't accomplished anything. And so I don't know. I haven't worked hard enough.
I don't believe that's true, but yeah. It's certainly true that a person can always do more in that.
Well, you know, when you're a student,
yes,
you read about the man that discovered vaccination.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, you'd like to do something like that too, wouldn't
mm-hmm.
you? Something that was really useful. Well,
yes.
How many men have really done something that was useful?
Mm-hmm.
You don't meet many of them today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that explains more. Did you feel, for example, in Atchison that, well, how many doctors were there at the time?
Well, about 10.
About 10. And how
and
many
I was better trained than most
uh-huh,
of them.
Yeah.
So I was accepted right away.
How many are there now, would you say? Of course, it's
about the same.
About the same.
Population has come down a little bit.
I see. Mm-hmm.
In a settled community like that, now when I went there, there are a lot of really high class people there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lawyers
mm-hmm.
and businessmen
mm-hmm.
and wealthy men. Now, the thing is we're getting leveled out more. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's harder to make money nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to be decent than make money.
Harder to keep it too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're living now in a post-war period,
mm-hmm.
which is a period of moral and technical disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going through that, and it'll take 10 or 20 years to get over.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any hope for the future then? Do you think things
oh,
will
yes.
get better?
Oh yeah, I think the United States is not done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I see a lot of evidence of degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
But just try to imagine, now I do this to kind of keep myself on an even keel.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine what the people went through just anterior to the Civil War. When they were discussing at the dinner table the pros and cons, when one went north and the other one went south and fought. Now we haven't gone through anything as strenuous as that, but we have fought a botched up war in East Asia, and we have wasted money
mm-hmm.
unconscionably.
Whose fault do you think that is?
I think largely Mr. Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would get. He was a politician, but not a man of insight or historical ability.
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded by sycophants
mm-hmm.
of all kinds. And I think the position of the presidency is a very difficult position.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a very strong man to hold that chair down, I think.
What do you think about Kennedy as the president?
I never liked the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
He's a saloon keeper's son to start with, on a big scale.
Mm-hmm.
His father went abroad and got the whiskey
mm-hmm.
monopoly. He got rich. And then he was Catholic, and that Catholic vote helped him a lot, which is not a proper foundation for becoming president of the United States.
Going back into history a little bit further, what about Franklin D. Roosevelt? What was your attitude towards him?
I didn't like him.
Uh-huh.
I didn't like his tone of voice
mm-hmm.
when he says, "My friends," That's all I had to hear, and I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Never met the man, don't know him.
Uh-huh. What about Truman?
Truman. Kansas City ward healer.
Uh-huh.
And now he's getting to be a very good man. Everybody thinks he's all right.
It is interesting.
I visited his exhibit there in Kansas City.
Yes. Uh-huh. It is interesting to see, isn't it, how reputations become revived 20 years after a person is dead.
How difficult it is for a man to be understood.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now a physician knows that.
Mm-hmm.
Every day you tell somebody something,
mm-hmm.
and then you hear the echo from that,
mm-hmm.
and it's
mm-hmm.
no relationship
mm-hmm.
to what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a daily occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to put it into words is one of the requirements
mm-hmm.
of the practicing physician.
Mm-hmm.
How many textbooks are written that are really, really bring it home to a student?
Mm-hmm.
I think the best textbook I ever read was a German textbook.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the name of it was, or the author?
There are a lot of German works that are very good.
Mm-hmm.
Heifetz.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't think of it right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have this ability to not remember the name when I
mm-hmm.
want it.
Well, I have that problem too. So
it's
so
terrible.
You're not alone in that.
It's terrible, yes.
Your attitude then is that you did work very hard as a physician, but
mm-hmm.
you didn't accomplish. You wished you'd accomplished even more. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think so. Yeah. When you get to be 90 years old,
mm-hmm.
you can look back quite a ways.
Yes.
And you don't see very much.
Uh-huh.
You wonder why. But that's true of any man, almost.
Mm-hmm.
How little... I was reading Napoleon's story in the Britannica the other
mm-hmm.
day. Now, the Britannica, I have an old Britannica, and I just bought one of these new ones.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Well, the new one isn't as good as the old one in many ways.
Mm-hmm. I think they've had to shorten things.
They shortened things, and they made smaller print so
yes.
they could get more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to read,
mm-hmm.
but not nearly as complete.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read that story of Napoleon. We used to have, when I went to high school, we used to have what they call study hours,
mm-hmm.
when you had no particular assignment. And one of the privileges was to go to the library.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I put in a lot of library hours reading the Britannica's
mm-hmm.
account of Napoleon. It was quite a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now I read it this time, just to compare
mm-hmm.
But how much has Napoleon done? When you think of a guy like that,
mm-hmm.
how many marks has he left
mm-hmm.
on civilization that you and I can
mm-hmm.
point to? Not very many.
Are you still practicing now, or
mm-hmm.
you are?
Yeah, I've been thinking of retiring for
uh-huh.
a long time, but
uh-huh.
I never quite have the courage to quit.
Are you doing part-time yet, or are you still...
Half days.
Mm-hmm.
Half day. When you don't do surgery, it gets you
mm-hmm.
out a lot of time-consuming
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Did you do surgery at one point in the past?
Oh yes, I've done
it.
I've done what came along.
Mm-hmm. You did do that as part of your career then.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. In eye, what, nose and throat also?
Yeah, but
mm-hmm.
mostly eye.
Mostly eye. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did a lot of cataracts, and I
uh-huh.
got good results.
Uh-huh.
I've had some misfortune,
uh-huh.
of course, but I have rather good instruction,
mm-hmm.
I think, in that. But of course, when I see them, the way they do them now. Boy, they take 3 hours, 2-3 hours,
uh-huh.
and have 9 people in the operating room.
Yes.
And the costs, the investment
uh-huh.
cost in the operating room, I'd like to know what it costs
mm-hmm.
furnace that operated. Mm-hmm. And what it cost to keep it going.
Well, ah, when we, did...
We couldn't do that. We couldn't exist on that kind of a basis. But it's everywhere. You take... I've just come back from a visit to Yale and Harvard. You see, it's the same thing there. They're doing it just like you're doing it. Lots of money. And wasteful procedures.
When did...
At our hospital, you could get a room for $5 a day. Up until recent years. Now it's about $58 a day, and we're the lowest in our whole area. Kansas City's about $100. What is it here?
I don't have the exact figures, but it would probably be
down
the same.
Down in Houston, it's $100. $200 a day. Kansas City, about $100 a day.
Well, do you think they're doing things could they be done in a less expensive way?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, everybody gets to be an opera singer after a while. They're too good to touch things if it isn't highly remunerated. I think that attitude exists pretty much. You got it from the lowest to the highest. President of General Motors. What is his salary? Do you know his salary?
No, I don't. I don't know.
$592,000, and not only that, he gets a pension. Not only that, his wife gets a pension when he dies. All that kind of stuff. You pay for it when you buy your car. I don't think that's necessary. Pensions. I wonder whether pensions are ever justifiable. I don't know. They grow out of the feeling that it's very different. It's very difficult to remunerate a man for his services. How are you going to figure services? Have you known anything about that?
No.
I had a rectal operation at the Mayo's about 46 years ago. In a year, it had to be done over. So one of my friends in Kansas City did it 45 years ago. I haven't had any trouble for 45 years. Now, how are you going to remunerate that kind of a job? Evidently, it was difficult. It wouldn't have been a failure the first time. Hemorrhoidal operation. How are you going to do that? When you do a cataract operation, you give a person vision to continue work or not to continue work. How are you going to put a price on that? Are you going to make it an absolute mathematical thing? You're going to eliminate everything but just the plain economics of it? How are you going to do it? And that's the life of the physician is going to depend on that. We are now the tail end of politics, rapidly becoming so. And if you do that, medicine's going to be just like the rest of the government, incompetent. All you have to learn about government incompetence is to be in the army a little while. And they proved it in East Asia. They did a magnificent job of proving it there. I'm convinced, as I've heard lots of people who should know say, that if that had been turned over to the army, it had been cleaned up in a very short time.
Speaking of politics and government, we were talking about various presidents, and I think we covered most of the recent ones, except President Nixon and now President Ford. What was your reaction to the events that surround these two men?
I always thought Nixon was all right. I don't know whether 50 years from now they'll decide that he was wrong. He evidently was doing what too many politicians are doing all the time. profiting by the position in some way or other. That makes him very vulnerable. And he's got plenty of enemies, of course, when he's in politics. I think the present man has had good training. I think he's got a terrible job. And I think he's all right. I can't go along with this criticism that says everything that's wrong goes is wrong because of president. Because of the president. I can't believe that.
We were talking also about operations and cataract operations. When did you perform your first operation in this field?
My first operation was on a private patient in Atchison. With all this training that I'd gone through, I'd never done it.
You never done
operation.
You mentioned that earlier.
And now these boys are doing it right now, and they're only third year men.
When you were an intern, and you were an assistant to a doctor too.
Dr. Ewing did all the surgery of the Green Post and Ewing office, practically all of it.
Well, what did Dr. Green specialize then in?
He was an ophthalmologist, but he was getting old, and he wasn't doing surgery anymore.
So Dr. Green was a senior
Dr.
doctor.
Post had a terrible tumor, and he kind of washed it off. So,
but at that point in your career, even though you
I saw
graduated,
a lot of surgery.
But you didn't do it yourself at that point.
No.
I
had no actual practice in surgery. My knowledge of surgery came from assisting and observing.
So then it was in Atchison that you did your first cataract operation.
That's right.
Yourself. Was that in, when was that approximately?
Well, I got there in 1911. I imagine this was a couple of years later.
Were they performing these kind of operations in St. Louis so that you could observe?
Oh, yeah. Dr. Ewing was an excellent operator, and I was with him for 2 years. He had beautiful results. But the equipment, my goodness. You've got thousands of dollars invested in something that cost us $1.
No comparison, really.
No comparison.
In equipment.
But we got good results. I've never seen nicer results than Dr. Ewing got. Although I've seen a lot of things done that he couldn't have done,
What other type of operations did you perform in the course of your practice?
Well,
mainly cataracts and...
Cataracts. Very few glaucoma operations. We do what sort of comes along. Most of them are injuries. Corneal injuries.
Did you get into the corneal transplant field at all?
I didn't get into that.
This
that,
is a relatively
that is a,
recent.
An institution, though. That's an institutional procedure.
I see.
You've got to get the material. It's got to be preserved. You've got to have assistance. I send those to institutions when I get them. They don't come very often. You see, in a hospital like this, which is a center, you get a wrong statistical idea of frequencies because it's a concentration point for the heavy stuff.
I think that's a very good point. I was reading about that, something about that just today, I think, that the average physician sees relatively few types of disease during its practice.
Sure, I've been in practice. I'm a busy practitioner. I now see 20 people a day. I used to see twice that many. Now, of course, a lot of that is just in and out stuff, you know. But I do good refraction work. I haven't seen good refraction work in any of these institutions. I haven't seen it. And, of course, in a teaching institution, when they get hold of something they want to teach with it, use it as material, that isn't always to the greatest benefit of the patient. You can understand that.
What type of in ophthalmology, and what would you consider a typical case or what type of cases did you see often, and which ones rarely?
The ones I see are people getting older. Now, of course, I've had a lot of chance to see people getting older. Mm-hmm. I've been there for 60 years. This person comes in with a clear cornea, and after a while, he got a cataract.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my privilege to see them through those terrible years when they still see enough but don't see enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's a terrible thing for a person to go through with. And my method has always been to avoid a cataract operation until the result would be psychically helpful as well as visually helpful. If you operate on a patient that still sees fairly well with one eye, and you operate on the other eye, he'd prefer this eye, even though the actual chart vision is better with the operated eye.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a dissatisfied patient. He said, "You operated on this eye, and I don't see it well now as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm troubled with this thing here. When it was blind, it didn't trouble me."
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've got that to fight. Now, in the big hospital, they do it anyway, and they explain to them it's going to be this way, and that it's a good thing. Because they're younger, they're a better operative risk, and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But they operate on everything that comes down the pike. Well, when you live with your patients, you don't do that. You're a little more careful.
Mm-hmm.
You consider this psychic side a little more. That makes less surgery, and that makes less income.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one thing that our hospitals are going to do to us. You're not going to have general practitioners. Everywhere now, you see they're having trouble in smaller towns getting somebody to come there. You don't see that, do you?
No.
You're in the big city and you're immersed in it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that at all. But I see that. Here's this town that used to have two doctors, now they haven't had a doctor for 10 years. Well, the roads are better, they can travel easier. The airplane will take them 500 miles in what used to take a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the institutions haven't treated the doctor in the country quite right. They steal his patients.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, the patient comes to a well-ordered place and he sees the elegance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the elegance of the people that are doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then he compares that with the home folks, and then it doesn't help the home folks very
mm-hmm.
much. Now, I think one of the things that the big institutions are going to have to do is to take care of that country boy, which they haven't been doing. They've been stealing his patients. Do you realize that?
How do they do that?
Well, you refer a patient to a hospital where there's a good man.
Mm-hmm.
If he's not a friend of yours, you probably lost the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so apparent to everybody that they're in a position to do maybe better work, or it's what looks like better work.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least something that's dressed up to look like better work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of dressing up.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's one feature. You know, one of the nice things about medicine is, now I travel around from different places. I've been in Rome, I didn't know a soul in Rome. Pretty soon I was standing at the side of the chief in the eye department doing an operation, talking to him. The same in Athens, the same in Munich, the same in Paris, the same in Boston and in New York and wherever you go.
Mm-hmm.
And in Washington University, St. Louis, it's a little more cold-blooded than any of them. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
I told Sherwood Moore that. Sherwood was a fine example of a cold exterior.
Mm-hmm.
I told him that because I wanted him to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could talk to him. He's a New Sigma Nu, you know. I'm a New Sigma
mm-hmm.
Nu. I could get him told.
Mm-hmm. Well, so your view is you feel this is not a recent thing, but it's something.
This goes back
this
all the way.
This goes back all the way.
All the
uh-huh.
way.
Uh-huh.
The only rebuff that I ever got in visiting was in the nose and throat department in this hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The man from Iowa, what was his name?
Iowa.
He was a chief at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good man.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want me to go in there and see these things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was a country boy. I was wanting to see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to hell with him if he doesn't want you. Because after all, we're all taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. You were, I don't mean to cut you off at this point, but you mentioned New Sigma Nu, and that reminded me of something that I wanted to talk to you about. We have...
I was in New Sigma Nu and Alpha Omega Alpha when I came to school.
We have the papers of New Sigma Nu, and I believe we've got one notebook from Alpha Omega Alpha. Is it?
I think you've got some. Have you got some of those pictures?
I don't think we've got many photographs of it.
Well, I think my picture's in one
mm-hmm.
of those books.
Oh, we've got the books.
Yeah, we have the directories.
We'll have to look at that.
I don't remember what year I joined.
This has. Ceased to exist at Washington University as a couple years ago, but the money that they had raised by selling their chapter house was put into a scholarship fund, and the scholarship fund of course still exists
here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a scholarship for one student. I don't know.
Let's see. I thought we could look up the information for you about that. I was reading that this morning.
You don't have fraternities anymore.
I don't believe there are any active ones.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All been ruled out, I guess. Well, it's a sort of a classification.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was a member of the New Sigma Nu
mm-hmm.
in the early days, and I know there was feeling there that they
mm-hmm.
were kind of
better
snooty, kind of snooty,
uh-huh.
you know.
The New Sigma Nu members.
And then,
uh-huh.
pretty soon after that, why the other boys. Organized one.
Uh-huh.
So there was competition.
Mm-hmm.
They were just as snooty as we were.
Uh-huh. Well, how did you get elected to membership?
Some friend put you in.
I see. Uh-huh.
And of course they took the better students as a rule.
I see.
Or the family background or
uh-huh.
whatever you want to know. I don't
uh-huh.
know. Friendship
uh-huh.
really. Boils down to friendship.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of things did the fraternity do?
It's a forum where you can spill the beans
mm-hmm.
and tell what you think and know that you're among friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can't do that ordinarily to a class. There's always somebody there that doesn't like you, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And so in a fraternity, there's more homogeneity, and
mm-hmm.
it's a good clearinghouse. And I've always been glad that I had that opportunity of being a member of that.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much alcohol in those days. There was some alcohol, but not
mm-hmm.
nobody ever overstepped that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose there was a certain snootiness about it, always. But I suppose life is full of that anyway, isn't it? Well, say, I've talked more here than I have for years,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Well, we thank you very much for coming today. The only thing I didn't get to ask you about was your family. Are you married?
Never was married. No, they had several escapes, but they never got married.
Well, thank you very much for stopping by today.
Well, I hope you won't give it any notoriety.
This concludes Oral History 19 with Dr. Eugene J. Brybeck.